Next speaker on the topic of healthcare reform is Dr. Steffi Woolhandler. She's with the City University of New York School of Public Health, and she is a co-founder of Physicians for National Health Program. Dr. Woolhandler.
Thank you. The number of uninsured Americans continues to rise. There's about 50 million uninsured Americans as we speak. This is due to a fall in private insurance coverage that's been going on for decades. In addition to the increase in the number of uninsured, there's been a very dramatic increase in the number of underinsured Americans, and this is extremely important in terms of understanding the problems of the ACA, of healthcare reform. Indeed, many people will be taken from being uninsured to being underinsured under the 2010 ACA. What does it mean to be underinsured? Well, women with breast cancer who have high copayments are unlikely to continue their hormone therapy, potentially life-saving hormone therapy, because they're underinsured. They have insurance, but they still can't afford things. It turns out, this is data that we put together with Elizabeth Warren about medical bankruptcy. It actually got a lot of traction. That more than half of U.S. bankruptcies are due in part to medical illness or medical bills. But one aspect got less attention, which is that the overwhelming majority of people suffering medical bankruptcy in the United States had health insurance when they first got ill, but unfortunately they were underinsured and were bankrupted anyway. This is in the context of a growing inequality in the society, driven by federal policies such as tax rates. The top tax rate has fallen dramatically in the U.S. over the past decades. And I've also graphed economic growth, and economic growth was, if anything, higher when there was a higher tax rate. The rhetoric about the job creators is just rhetoric. Now, the other side of healthcare is the tremendous growth of administration and administrative costs, with overhead at some of the largest HMOs now about 22%, meaning for each dollar that you pay to an HMO, only 78 cents ever comes out to pay a doctor, a nurse, even a drug company. The rest stays right there with that corporation as their overhead and profit. Some people do very well in the HMO setting. These are the pay packages of several major insurance CEOs. Meanwhile, the United States is paying a significant amount out of taxes for health care. Indeed, the tax-supported spending in the United States is as large as total spending in many other large nations. I've graphed total per capita spending of other nations on the top in blue, U.S. per capita spending on the bottom, divided into two segments, public and private. And in the public, I've included not just Medicare, Medicaid, VA, but also the benefit costs of public workers, such as myself, which of course is paid by taxpayers, and the so-called tax subsidy to private insurance that heavily subsidizes healthcare, private healthcare for affluent people. What do we get for this extra spending? We don't get additional life expectancy. We don't get additional days in the hospital. Patients leave quicker and sicker. We don't get more physician care than folks in other nations. And for the first time, there's an international collaborative to measure hospital quality. And quality in the United States is certainly not above average, if anything, average or a little below. Meanwhile, if we look at the difference in health spending between the United States and Canada, a nation with national health insurance, we see that approximately half of the total spending difference is due to spending on bureaucracy, on the paperwork and expense related to having private health insurance as the middleman in our healthcare system. The world's leading medical journal, The Lancet, has described the health reform process in the U.S. by saying the health reform process exposes how corporate influence renders the U.S. government incapable of making policy on the basis of evidence and the public interest. Now, as you know, Massachusetts was the model for the national reform. We've had the national model in place since 2006, and we did indeed see a fall in our uninsurance rate by about half. However, in the most recent year, it's going up. So we did see some improvement, I guess, if you will, in the number of uninsured. But we've also had some fairly draconian measures to mandate health care. And you can get a $50 fine for violating child labor laws, but go without insurance, and the fine is $1,212 a month. Not many in Massachusetts, despite the reform, report that they cannot afford care, with one in seven acquiring new medical debt in the last 12 months, similar number unable to fill prescriptions. Now, why is this? In fact, the new coverage in Massachusetts is quite skimpy. This is the required coverage if you go on the exchange website. For someone my age who bought the required coverage, it has something called 70% actuarial value. That is, it will cover only 70% of my medical costs. But for this, I have to pay $5,600 annually in premiums, plus a $2,000 deductible, so $7,600 out of pocket before my insurance pays a penny, and there's a 20% co-insurance after the deductible is met. So that's what we're offering, woeful underinsurance. Unfortunately, the Institute of Medicine just said that this type of underinsurance is what will be the essential health benefits, will be the required benefits under the Accountable Care Act. And just a reminder that small employer coverage tends to come with massive deductibles, and the Institute of Medicine has said that all you need to do is have coverage like a small employer. Okay. So we've been protesting the IOM's new statement. If people are interested in that, we can talk about it later. Massachusetts reform has not generated an increase in the caregivers, but has tremendously increased bureaucracy in the state, according to this article in the New England Journal. And finally, the federal taxpayers have paid for Massachusetts reform. The reason it appears affordable for the state is because federal tax people from the other 49 states are paying for Massachusetts reform, something that obviously doesn't work very well when you do it in 50 states. So what will the impact of the national reform be? According to the Congressional Budget Office, it will cover only half of the uninsured. The number of uninsured will be reduced from 50 million to 24 million. It comes with a $36 billion cut in safety net funding and a small increase in community health center funding. That's the good news. Impact on the underinsured, President Obama told us if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. He neglected to mention that if you don't like your current job-based coverage, you have to keep it. It's required. You can't go through the exchange. You can't get a subsidy. And the policies will be required to cover only 60% of health costs. That's actually less than the 70% policy I showed you in Massachusetts. So we'll see a significant increase in underinsurance. The health care reform bill, proven cost control provisions, and this is not a typo. There's no proven cost control provisions in the bill whatsoever. I want to spend the time talking about the ACO, because the ACOs, the Accountable Care Organizations, these new organizations, are all the rage in the medical care community if you work in health care. These are being pushed forward despite the fact that Medicare ran a demonstration project and saw that ACOs did not work. The sites produced apparent savings, got bonus payments, but it was all due to coding changes, upcoding, playing games. Now, upcoding is the Achilles heel of risk adjustment and hence of accountable care organizations, and for that matter, pay for performance. By maximizing the number of coded diagnoses, you can make patients appear sicker on paper, your outcomes will look better, and you'll increase your payments if it's being risk adjusted. Now, one hospital, and this is a true story, had an emergency. Their risk-adjusted Medicare mortality was 1.42. So in response, they spent $500,000 on coding consultants, and they got their risk-adjusted mortality to fall up dramatically, and they got a $3 million increase in reimbursement. They did this by basically using synonyms, going and telling the doctors, don't say acute kidney insufficiency, say acute renal failure, because acute renal failure counts to make the patient look sicker and increases the reimbursement and makes our risk-adjusted mortality lower. And there's a whole list of synonyms there. Medicare tried to improve risk adjustment in 2004. They had previously risk-adjusted HMO payments. The payments to Medicare HMOs merely for age, gender, locale, a few other things like disability and ESRD. And in 2004, the CMS actuaries, who are actually pretty smart people and have a lot of data at hand, developed a risk adjustment formula that was going to put people into 70 categories and was supposed to correct the gaming that was going on within the Medicare HMO system, the cherry picking of healthy people that was allowing HMOs to cheat Medicare. And yet when Medicare enhanced their risk adjustment, the overpayment to Medicare HMOs actually increased. They were able to use the new risk adjustment formula to game the system and increase their ripoff of the federal taxpayers. Turns out that the enhanced risk adjustment increased the overpayment to HMOs, so that in 2006, the total overpayment to these HMOs was over $30 billion. Even in healthcare, that's real money. That's 8% of the Medicare budget being paid out as overpayment to corporate providers. Now, the failure of Medicare HMO risk adjustment has important implications for ACOs. It means ACOs won't save money, that resources due to cherry picking, resources will be transferred to HMOs that cherry pick, and they'll be transferred from healthy to the sick. That's backward. The biggest cheaters will be the biggest winners, and ACOs that embrace problem patients will be driven from the market. That's the implication of the failure of risk adjustment within the Medicare HMO experiment. So ACOs are, in effect, a privatization of health planning. We all support the idea of health planning, but it cannot be done on a private corporate basis. It has to be done on a public basis. The big problem is your HMO is paying me big bucks to hold down your treatment costs. You want to make me a better offer. You basically can't pay people a set payment and tell them they can keep whatever they don't spend on patients as a profit. That does not work. It's a prescription for cherry picking. It's a prescription for patient abuse. Now, what about the possibilities for real health reform when you ask the American people if they would prefer what we have now, or a universal coverage program like Medicare that is government-run and financed by taxpayers? And this is actually the last time the question was asked in this format. A clear majority say, you know, give me a government tax-financed program. Okay. Even in Massachusetts, when you ask the physicians who have extensive experience with the reform model in the 2010 reform nationally, we already have that experience, and this is from the Massachusetts Medical Society. It turns out that a plurality of Massachusetts physicians endorsed the idea of single payer, with only 17% saying Massachusetts reform would be the preferred option. Now, this is the problem. Wall Street occupies our government. They don't express the will of the people to support a Medicare for All nonprofit national health insurance program. And these people's solution, and I think a good one, is to occupy Wall Street, because the folks on Wall Street are actually very happy with the way things are. The 2010 reform met their needs at the expense of meeting the needs of the American people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Given the lateness of the hour, we're going to go on to the next presentation. Thank you very much, Dr. Wolhandler. I encourage you to have her speak with Dr. Wolhandler after the session if you have some questions.